You ever feel like you're at life's impasse? You wonder where to go, how to go forward. You can't move sideways. It seems the only way is the way back, and that's not a good road. So how do you find your way forward? Well, that's a great question, and we've got a great answer for you today and tomorrow here on Abounding Grace with our teacher and pastor, Chris Gordon. Hi there. Thanks for taking a few minutes and joining us today. The title of today's message is Jesus Gives You a Way Forward. We're in Mark chapter 9, verses 14 through 29. If you're familiar with your scriptures, you'll know that's where Jesus heals a boy possessed by an impure spirit. And there's a lot of lessons to be learned in this section of Scripture. Join us. Here's Pastor Chris.
Last time, we considered together in Mark's Gospel the Transfiguration in Mark chapter 9, and we move on this morning to Jesus healing a boy with an unclean spirit. So we will be reading together verses 14 through 29 of the Gospel of Mark. That's the second book in the New Testament, Gospel of Mark, beginning at verse 14. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed, and they ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer." May the Lord bless the hearing of his word. In the previous section, Mark took us up on the mountain, if you will, with, you remember, Peter, James, and John. And there we looked at the transfiguration of Jesus. We saw the context of that. We looked at the context of that transfiguration where Jesus was giving them a momentary display of his glory, future resurrection glory, if you will, because he didn't want it talked about until the resurrection. But he was answering their discouragement in their present struggle. And the main reason for that discouragement that they were facing is because they were not listening to what he was declaring to them. All sorts of presuppositions, all sorts of things come into our heads, and often we don't even hear the word of the Lord because we have our idea of how it's supposed to go, what it's supposed to be, and anything different than our plan, anything different than the way we have deemed it's going to go, it is like hitting a wall when we're spoken to. Well, Jesus was correcting this, but it was a powerful moment, for it was the voice of the Father that came out of the cloud and said, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. I want you to listen to him, to what he's telling you." That was a great gift from the Lord to take them up there, to show them his glory, to see the outcome, to encourage them in all of their discouragement. He gave them that privilege. Jesus had been saying something, though, that they wouldn't accept. And this was what the Father was really telling them to listen to. Jesus had been saying, and he's going to keep saying until it happens, I am going to die. I've got a cross. And then on the third day, I'm going to rise again. They couldn't even hear about the resurrection. It was the death of Christ that stumbled them. But Jesus was making clear that the pathway to glory, the pathway to that future glory that they just witnessed, would come by way of suffering and a cross. Suffering precedes it. There's a kind of rule here to all of this, if you will. We enter the kingdom ourselves. Through much tribulation, we enter the kingdom. All who desire to live godly in Christ are going to suffer. Contra the message of everyone who tells you, you come to Christianity, everything's going to be great. It's one thing, though, to accept that Jesus will die. But it's quite another thing to understand why he must die. And that's where we land today. In our passage this morning, we have Jesus coming down the mountain and making clear that part of the cross that he is carrying, and remember, he's not doing this for himself. He's doing this for us. He's doing this to purchase us. He's doing this because the Father had given to him his people. Not one would be lost. Part of the cross that he was carrying for us was the defeat of Satan and his realm. And if we don't understand that, if we don't understand that it's specifically Jesus' work to conquer the devil and Satan, to conquer the demonic realm, this life will not only be one of great discouragement, but it'll be one of constant defeat. It'll be one where you are constantly trying yourself to have the power to overcome and wonder why it's never working. Think about all the faith healers, all the people who say, I command, and think that they have the power over the demonic realm. Think about this for a minute. This is major discouragement. If that's the way that we live, because we have tried to take things on our own. And Jesus has a clear message for us as he comes down the mountain. Here he had it for his disciples and he has for us. That the way forward in my absence is not by your strength. You too carry a cross. There's no doubt. He said that in the previous section. You're going to carry your cross. But the way that you face your cross, the way that you go forward in identifying with me, you have to listen carefully and understand what I'm showing and what I'm saying to you about how you're going to handle this cross. More people do not listen to how he's telling us to handle the cross that we carry. And because of that, life is a mess. Listen to him, says the Father. So this is Jesus this morning giving them a way forward. And in this way, he is showing them and demonstrating and promising to them his help. It's what we just sung out from the psalm. He delights to give us help in time of need, even when he's absent. And so as we look at this passage this morning, I see here what could be deemed right at the beginning an embarrassing defeat, a tragic exposure, and then an encouraging solution. An embarrassing defeat, a tragic exposure, and an encouraging solution. One of the things that Mark is showing us is that Jesus is using these events to train his disciples. You know this is training time. Things are escalating to the cross. The events that are happening at this point would be largely imprinted on their minds forever as they went out to take the gospel to the ends of the earth. They needed this. These would be the things they would look back to and say, ah, remember that? Holy Spirit would bring it to their minds, and they would say, this is what he was teaching us once they understood in the resurrection. They didn't understand it all right now. One of the things here that Mark is showing us in this training is how to move forward in his absence. The story is told by one of them, as generally received, the story is told here by one of them who came down the mountain. And that is most likely Peter, as there has been a long history and tradition of what is recorded here as coming from Peter. He had just given Peter, James, and John up on the mountain to see his glory. They had seen the transfiguration. But where were the other ones? Not all of them were there. Not all of them got to see this. Not all of them were privileged to see that. So while three of them were able to see that glory, you'll notice here that nine of them, Jesus has not neglected. In fact, this becomes a giant moment of training for them. It would be one of the most important lessons that they would ever learn right here. Below now are the other nine. What were they doing during this moment of transfiguration? What were they doing as Jesus had departed with these three and gone up on the mountain? Jesus, of course, has been up on the mountain with who? Moses and Elijah. What was happening at the foot of the mountain? Well, Jesus descends now with the three from the mountain. We read that in the other Gospels. He descended. And we read in verse 14 here in our text, "And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and the scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, 'What are you arguing about with them?'" Fascinating moment. Here is what is happening at the foot of the mountain. A man has a son. You'll notice that here. A man has a son at the foot of the mountain who is being absolutely assaulted by a demon. It was a kind of epilepsy, but in the sense that this was much worse than that, because the demon used that weakness to destroy the child. It seemed that the demon was assaulting his brain, causing seizures, and it was an awful display. The demon would slam him to the ground, and not only did he foam, but he would gnash his teeth and his whole body would stiffen out. I mean, this was a real sight, an awful sight to behold. Can you think of anything worse than to see this happening to a little boy? So the disciples come along while Jesus is up on the mountain, and they have all these people there gathered around this boy, and the disciples began to attempt to cast out this demon. But they couldn't. They had absolutely no power to do it. And all of a sudden, this gave great opportunity for the scribes to come along and begin mocking. This gave great opportunity for the scribes to come along to provoke them, to mock them. And you can imagine the scene, the disciples trying over and over, "Come out!" Nothing. "Come out!" I don't know what they tried at the bottom of the mountain, but I'm sure they tried a lot of different things to get this demon out. Nothing happens. People are laughing. Scribes are mocking. In some sense, I can't help, and maybe this is going too far, but I can't help but see a sort of culmination here of all the bad events on mountains in Israel's history. Moses and Elijah is up there. You can't help but think about the Mount Carmel event, where all of Israel's gathered around, remember, Baal worship. And remember, Elijah's up there. What is he saying? "Well, maybe your God is going to the bathroom." And that's the nice way to say it. Anyone who knows the Hebrew knows that. But that's exactly what it says. Maybe he's doing that. Can you imagine the scribe saying that? Where's Jesus? Maybe he's out going to the bathroom. I think they're repeating history, they think. Even worse, there are overtones here of the golden calf event. Jesus and Moses were just up on the mountain together. When Moses was up on the mountain in Exodus, we're going to come to a section here in chapter 24 where he ate and he drank, beholding the glory of God, and I'll look forward to this, in the face of Jesus Christ. Christ was up on the mountain with Moses in the days of Exodus. Moses comes down the mountain, and what did he find when he came down the mountain? A huge, faithless scene at the bottom of the mountain, in complete impatience, in complete absence of what they said. "Well, where is this God? He's nowhere to be found. We're going to do it our way. We're going to bring God to us our way, and we're going to go forward our way." And they ended up in the worst kind of scene of idolatry that you could come up with. So they tried to bring in Exodus the Lord to them their way. It's idolatry. That ultimately is the cause and essence of all idolatry. This is helpful, that we have the same kind of moment now after Jesus has been on the mountain, and you could imagine Moses as he's heading back up into glory, shaking his head, right? Another conjecture. Jesus comes down to the same ugly scene of unbelief. The disciples are caught up in it, trying to cast out a demon with absolutely no power. And if you want to know how serious Jesus took this, how agitated Jesus was by this, It maybe to you doesn't seem as serious. But here, Jesus is crying out when he sees this, "Oh, faithless generation and perverse generation, faithless generation, how long shall I bear with you? How long shall I put up with you?" This was a cry of anger. This was a cry of pain. Whatever just happened, it very much affected him in the worst sort of way, to which we're all standing back. Well, what did happen here? I really want to understand what just happened here. Calling it a scene of total unbelief is really quite a charge, isn't it? Faithless. What was wrong? This wasn't the easiest passage to work through this week. I struggled long and hard on this one. You can ask my wife. She's tired of hearing me talk about this one. I have no problem understanding why he said this to the scribes. I mean, they're just ruthless. They are absolutely, all they want to do is catch him in a trap and destroy him. I have no problem understanding that. But he's calling it a generation, and everyone understands he's looking at everyone in this whole mix. What I think is crucial to see again is that this has become a sort of test for the disciples. We just came off the mountain. Think about the scene here. Peter's looking at this coming down the mountain. We just came off the mountain, and God the Father had just diagnosed the problem that they were not listening to his Son. Who's listening to the Son? Listen to him. Well, here they descend on an earthly father and a son. This son is demon-possessed. On what basis could this earthly father or this son be helped? Had not the disciples learned anything yet? If they were, the problem with the disciples is that they were not listening to the Son of God, how did their actions at the foot of the mountain show that? One of the things that Mark keeps showing us over and over here is Jesus' power over the demonic realm. We've looked at this all the way back from chapter 1, even in the, remember in the synagogue, one of the earliest events where he was casting out demons. Jesus' power and authority over the demonic realm. And as we put this together, as we heard everything last time in the transfiguration of the pathway of suffering to enter into glory, one of the things that Mark has made really clear to us is that the way that Jesus is going to accomplish this, to carry our sorrows and to carry our sufferings, would include a direct confrontation with Satan and with the demonic realm. We've got to understand that. Here is an earthly father with his beloved only son, and he is saying, "I brought him to you, Jesus, but you weren't here. So I took him right to your disciples so that they should cast it out." But they couldn't. Now the question is why couldn't they? The disciples were totally humiliated at the bottom of the mountain. Why couldn't they cast it out? Here's a big moment in this particular scene where Jesus exercises compassion on this father and his son. And Jesus asks the caring question, not because he needed to know it, but because he wanted everyone to hear it, to demonstrate his care. "How long has this been going on?" And the father says, "From childhood, this demon has thrown my child into the fire and into the water. He has tried to destroy him so many times. And here it comes. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus says, "If you can, if you can." How did he say it? Again, I'd love to hear the tone on that one. Was it, "If you can"? If you can? Really? He had just put his hand on the problem, however way we hear it. How do you capture it? Now, it's striking here that back in Mark chapter 1, the leper came to Jesus and said, "Lord, if you're willing." And Jesus says, "I'm willing. If you can." And now we're starting to get at how serious Jesus is taking unbelief, aren't we? He is clearly agitated in this particular section to make a very powerful point in front of his disciples and to go after them too. "Oh, faithless generation." He was talking to everyone there. And in the next breath, he says, all things are possible to him who believes. Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Jesus was saying, someone who believes in me, and this is the point he's making here, is not going to put a limit on what I can do. Someone who believes in me is not going to hold and throw around limits on me, which is what everyone in this scene is doing. The problem is not me, says Jesus. The problem is this. It is whether you have the faith to believe. That's the problem we all have to think about here. That's the problem all of you have to think about here. The problem is not me. I've got sufficient power. The problem is you. This is what he said to the multitude that day. The problem is whether one has faith. When you begin to put the problem of the disciples together with this, I think it helps to get where we need to go this morning. And that takes us to the end of the passage at this point, where I believe it's really helpful to put this together, the Father who is in some way illustrating the problem of the disciples. When Jesus had descended on this scene of unbelief, remember that particularly Jesus had already commissioned the disciples and given them power over unclean spirits. Do you remember that when he sent them out in the mini mission, the trial mission? I give you power over the unclean spirits. They're totally baffled. I'm sure they're thinking, but you said you gave us power over the unclean spirits. But Jesus in this particular section is the object of no one's faith. On the one hand, a man came hoping that Jesus could, and that was setting limits on him. And then, when he wasn't there, went to his disciples, and the disciples act as if they have this power automatically, don't they? The disciples begin to take the situation into their own hands, and a lack of faith is seen how they expected to be able to do it, and here's the key this morning, apart from Jesus. They presumed on that power. This was like in the Old Testament, hey, let's put the ark out in the middle of the field and we'll defeat the Philistines. This should be no problem for us. What's missing here? Well, that's why it's helpful to go to the end of this. At the end of this whole scene, they walk up to Jesus and they say, Jesus, why couldn't we? And he says something very interesting. I'm sure you've all thought about it. This kind cannot be driven out by nothing but prayer. Isn't that a fascinating statement to make? We want to know why we can do this. And Jesus says, it can't go out except by prayer. What that means is that whatever kind of satanic assault they were confronted with, this was a demonstration of the worst kind of bondage that Satan brings upon people. I think when he says kind, he's having us think about something that Satan does that is the worst kind of act, and is the worst kind of act that Satan and his kingdom does is try to destroy you. Utterly destroy your lives. His business is to destroy lives. You see it all the time. People's lives, they want to destroy themselves, and Satan's behind that. What is more painful than seeing him do that to a child? Jesus is about to send them out as his ambassadors. What did they need to learn? How would they defeat this enemy? I mean, that's a training question, isn't it? It's a very simple thing Jesus was saying. You ready? Way simpler than you ever thought. The reason you were powerless is because you didn't pray.
This is Abounding Grace with Pastor Chris Gordon. Just enough time to leave you with our contact information. We'd love to hear from you. It's always a delight knowing you're being blessed by this radio program. Reach out to us at our website, agradio.org. Questions@agradio.org if you wish to email us any questions you might have or praise reports, comments about the program. Or give us a call, 888-504-8805. By the way, when you visit our website, agradio.org, tons of resource material for you to tap into, as well as links to our other platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Again, all at agradio.org. And that phone number, once again, is 888-504-8805. Looking to write to us? If you're old school, the address for your envelope is Abounding Grace Radio, P.O. Box 732, Linden, Washington. The zip code is 98264. Hey, thanks for joining us today. Until next time, God bless. Abounding Grace is brought to you on this radio station by Abounding Grace Radio Ministries.
Hi, this is Chris Gordon, pastor of the Escondido United Reformed Church. I'd like to invite you to our Sunday worship services at 9:30 a.m. and 5 o'clock p.m. on Sunday. We have two worship services, 9:30 a.m. and 5 o'clock p.m. We preach Christ and Him crucified with the goal that you would live in the joy of this comfort in the knowledge of the forgiveness of all of your sins. 1864 North Broadway is the address here in Escondido. We'd love to see you this Sunday.